Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment to discuss the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission's final report on the Wall Street meltdown that will be made public tomorrow. William Cohan, who covers Wall Street for Fortune and the New York Times, joins us. Then we will look into the seizure of 20 gun runners and 700 guns in Arizona that were destined for the Sinaloa cartel in Mexico. Gerald Nunziato, who developed gun tracing methods for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms, joins us to explain how much law enforcement is crippled by the NRA's representatives in Congress in their efforts to stop gun trafficking. Then we'll go to Cairo, Egypt, for an update on today's demonstrations in what many see as a prelude to a revolution like the recent one in Tunisia. Samia Sarigaldan joins us. She is the author of Cairo House, an autobiography that traces recent political developments in Egypt. I'm Ian Masters again, and I'm speaking with William Cohan, who is a contributing editor at Fortune and a writer for Vanity Fair and the New York Times. His acclaimed book, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, details the last days of Bear Stearns and Company. He began his career as an investigative reporter in Raleigh, North Carolina, and then went on to work on Wall Street for over a decade and a half, both for Lazard Frere and J.P. Morgan Chase. In 2007, he published The Last Tycoons, The Secret History of Lazard Frere and Company. He's currently working on a book about Goldman Sachs, which I think should be coming out pretty soon, right, William?
Yes, in the first half of this year. So.
Good. Well, we'll be the first on the block to call you about that one.
Can't wait.
Let me talk about this report that's coming out tomorrow, and there have been some leaks from it, obviously. Mm. Already we know that it's a political football because the report is only the majority report from the Democrats. The Republicans are sufficiently irritated that they even have two separate dissenting reports, don't they?
Yes, that's right, which, I mean, the dissension sort of all began at the beginning of December, which was when the original report was supposed to come out. But because of the dissension, and maybe just because it took longer to write the report than people thought, the Republicans said, hey, guess what? We don't agree with what the direction that the Democrats are going on this, so we're going to have our own report. And then there was another individual, Peter Wallison, a Republican, who dissented from the Republican dissent. So a lot of people are saying, you know, as a result, it doesn't have the authority that, say, the 9/11 report had. You know, Ian, I'm actually in you know, fairly strong disagreement with that. I have a feeling that it's going to be quite impactful in that I think it's going to reveal a lot of what really happened here.
Well, the minority Republican report is from somebody that's quite obsessed with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and he wants to make the government responsible for this as opposed to Wall Street.
Yes, correct.
But given the majority report, and of course the Republicans did resort to almost childish things where they wanted all references to derivatives and Wall Street cut from the report, it's though they're trying to sanitize history here. I suppose one should be gratified at least that the report finds fault with the federal chairman, Alan Greenspan, who for decades was considered a genius and clearly was completely blind to this. And he's being held culpable along with his successor, Ben Bernanke.
Yes. Since, as you pointed out at the top of the show, the report is actually being released early this tomorrow morning. All I know for sure is sort of what I read in the New York Times, which is probably a very good source on this, who had a reporter for which got a copy of the final report and is quoting from it. Bernanke was criticized, and Greenspan was criticized, and you know, I think that probably makes a lot of sense. They were both chairman of the Federal Reserve when these first the real estate bubble was inflated under Greenspan, and then the failure, I think, to act. It's not that they, I think Bernanke probably saw what was happening but chose not to act and hoped that maybe it would just all go away. And I think they're probably deserving of criticism correctly. You know, the other group that I think is deserved in coming and being criticized is Wall Street itself. I think this, as the report says, this is an entirely preventable crisis, sadly. It was an entirely man-made crisis. sadly. It could have absolutely been prevented. It did not have to happen. And that, you know, frankly, is the finding that I came up with in my book, House of Cards, about Bear Stearns, which was really the canary in the coal mine of the crisis. And everything that I've researched about the crisis, everything I've read about the crisis, everything I've written about the crisis, leads me over and over and over again to that very same conclusion that the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission came up to, which is that this was a man-made, self-inflicted wound, did not have to happen. And so I applaud them for coming up with that decision and telling it like it is, because that really is what happened here. And I think any other explanation really kind of whitewashes it. So I'm proud of them.
And in terms of the president's State of the Union last night, William Cohen is an online columnist for The New York Times, former investment banker and author of House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street. We're talking about the Commission of Inquiry on Wall Street's report that comes out tomorrow. The president did not mention anything that we're talking about. Obviously, maybe he's going to let this thing find its way into the press and into the political debate. But most of what we hear about what he's proposing, what the Republicans are proposing about how to fix the economy, seems absurd. They're only talking about 12% of the economy, which is discretionary spending, which has already been cut. So I don't know how they're going to make the real savings that they are. And to the president's credit, at least he did try and put that in context. I just get the feeling that everything that's happening out there is totally theatrical and has no relevance to the real world. And it's almost as absurd as the Republican response when the congressman who responded to the president spent a couple of minutes at the opening talking about Gabrielle Giffords, their colleague that was shot, without mentioning guns. So it seems to me that there's so much of our political debate is just simply off the record. I mean, not on the record, but they can't even talk about real stuff.
Well, we do seem to be heavily in the mode of theatrics, at the moment. To talk about Congressman Giffords without talking about the Second Amendment and what I think should be a repeal of the Second Amendment. I cannot imagine why people need to carry guns in this day and age. I just don't see what it accomplishes. I can see it, at one point maybe it made sense, when we had to hunt and gather for our food, but we don't have to do that anymore. It just seems to me that guns lead to nothing but trouble. In terms of talking about the real issues that are affecting the economy, I mean, on the one hand, President Obama last night was, looking prospectively to the future, was sort of being, thinking out loud about how this once great country can be great again, and the things that make this country great, its entrepreneurial spirit, its can-do spirit, our ability to think big. Remember at the end of the speech he was talking about thinking big. Of that is extremely true. And he tried to, compare this moment in that we're having such difficulties in our economy to a Sputnik moment. I think that's not a bad, obviously the metaphor is a little strained, but I do think that, we do need to face up to our problems in a major way. Now, ironically, I think his rhetoric is fabulous. But I think, what is really going on in actuality, I've just found to be, astounding in that, maybe it's the definition of genius, Ian, the ability to hold two competing thoughts in your head at the same time. I mean, on the one hand, he's talking about a Sputnik moment, how we all have to pull together to solve some of these problems. And on the other hand, this is the guy who signed the new tax bill during the lame duck session that added something like $900 billion to the deficit, which now is something like, $1.5 trillion, I think the Wall Street Journal is reporting today. That's a new, higher figure than had been reported before. And, we're not doing anything to address these budget deficits, which are going to be, extremely fiscally debilitating. We can't pretend anymore that these kinds of that other countries are going to suffer. What's happening in Ireland or the UK, where they're making big, deep budget cuts, or what happened in Greece, or what's happening in Portugal or Spain or Italy. Why are we pretending that those things are only going to happen to countries on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. Our fiscal irresponsibility is going to catch up with us. And you know, for all this talk of the new Congress being put in place to deal with these fiscal problems, I don't see any, you know, I know it's the early weeks. I know, you know, basically they were out of business last week because of Congressman Giffords, but I really think I didn't hear anything particularly inspiring last night on the subject of cutting the deficit, and I don't really hear anything out of the Republican Congress about cutting the deficit, and this is extremely troubling to me because, you know, we don't have anywhere else to go on monetary policy. Our fiscal house is not in order. In no time, in my view, we're going to be caught with the same kind of, you know, infection that is over in Europe is going to infect us. There's just no other way to do it. We are as we saw in this financial crisis in 2007 and 2008, we are in an incredibly interwoven world. I mean, everything is interconnected now. And to think that what's going on over there is not going to affect us is just foolishness.
Again, William Cohen, I was struck by how the President's State of the Union felt like a kind of pep rally for corporate America. And I'm wondering whether you think the President's plan to link corporate tax breaks with overhauling the entire tax structure for corporations and getting rid of all the loopholes and leveling the playing field.
Well, Ian, there's no question that ever since the Dodd-Frank bill was signed last summer, I mean, first of all, you know, in the year leading up to the signing of the Dodd-Frank financial re-regulation law, Wall Street and businessmen were demonized. That seemed to be very politically expedient. I think the Obama administration went way too far in that regard. Now I think they're going way too far in the other direction. You know, last night, you know, you talked about our entrepreneurial spirit and all the great can-do things we can do in this country. You know, if only business would get back on track and all the tax breaks for business and the appointment of Jeffrey Immelt, the CEO of GE, as a special advisor to Obama to get back, you know, to try to create more jobs. I mean, all of a sudden he went from demonizing Wall Street and businessmen to being their best friend. And the pendulum swings are too much because it implies extremes of behavior, and that's not the way life really works. You know, in the real world, two things can happen at the same time. On the same night that he gave the State of the Union address last night, we had the beginning of the leaks from the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, which clearly blamed Wall Street for this, as we were discussing at the top of the show, and for him not even to mention this report last night is mind-boggling. I mean, how can we just go forward and pretend that the role that Wall Street bankers, traders, and executives, among others, had in this financial crisis never even exists? It never even existed. I mean, it's almost like psychotic behavior. I mean, I think we need to really focus on improving things together and by admitting what's gone wrong in the past.
Well, that's what I meant, I think, earlier, William Cohen, about the kind of the black holes in our political debate where we just simply don't talk about the serious connections between policy and reality, whether it's guns or Wall Street. But you had a very interesting piece in the New York Times a few days ago, What's Good for GM is Good for Homeowners. I was very disappointed and still am about the way that this rash of foreclosures have been mishandled and the government band-aids aren't working and there's an awful lot of foreclosures in the pipeline. Apparently this year is going to be as bad as ever, if not worse. You know, he could have made something out of the fact that for all of the absurd talk about socialism, General Motors was rescued by a socialist government and is now humming along and the biggest car supplier in China. Why not borrow from that model, as you've argued in your New York Times piece?
Well, it's truly disgraceful how big corporations are able to use the bankruptcy court to restructure their debts. I mean, that's what it's there for, and that's what they, you know, and that's what they rightly do, and that's how GM and Chrysler were allowed to shed billions of dollars in debt and other liabilities and reemerge as, you know, new companies that we all applaud and are all getting so excited about and patting each other on the back about. But yet homeowners aren't entitled to that same privilege. It seems to me that, you know, if their choices are either to make their mortgage payments on time, as if, you know, they had plenty of cash, as if they, you know, had taken out the right amount of mortgage, as if they hadn't borrowed too much debt, their choices are either to make those payments on time or face foreclosure, by and large. Why is it that, you know, corporations who have billions and billions of debt they can't pay back, that they should never have borrowed in the first place, they're allowed to flush, you know, their debts that they can't pay in bankruptcy court, but homeowners aren't allowed to do that. Their choices are foreclosure or paying, you know, the mortgage on time every month. And it seems to me that the banks could very easily go through the procedures. Yes, it would be time-consuming, but no more time-consuming than it is for them to grapple with the GM bankruptcy or any other big bankruptcy that they have to come to grips with, that they lent money that they're never going to get back. They should look at the circumstances that every homeowner has. They should carefully evaluate the value of the house, the amount of the loan, the amount of the cash flows that individuals have and can make payments, and restructure, remodify these loans, as it's called, modify these mortgages, allow people to take more time to make mortgage payments at different rates, perhaps lower rates of interest, reduce the mortgage amount, turn a non-productive mortgage asset that's sitting on a bank's book into a productive mortgage asset that's sitting on a bank's books where the mortgage holder pays off the mortgage over a longer period of time at different interest rates and can still stay in his home. Seems to me that would do so much to make people feel better about their financial situation, about their homes, make banks feel better about all these mortgages that they have that are now pushing into foreclosure. And it would help the whole economy by not making the home ownership a sinkhole. It would begin to restore home ownership as being part of the American dream. Why banks don't do that, I have no idea. It just seems absolutely outrageous to me that corporations can do it and everybody applauds, but homeowners can't do it.
Just in the last couple of seconds, William Cohan, we know that the rest of the world, the Saudis and the sovereign funds, are now steering away from Wall Street because of what happened. They're not going to put their money in the hand of these kind of casino gamblers anymore. And the fact that nobody's serious, even if the president intends to be, the Congress aren't serious about fixing the economy. Is this a signal to the world that the U.S. can't get its act together?
Well, you know, Ian, I think it should be. I mean, and why the rating agencies are so busy downgrading the debt of European countries on the periphery of Central Europe, why they're not, you know, using that same hard microscope on the U.S. fiscal situation is mind-boggling to me. I mean, just because you know, the Chinese and the Japanese and the Koreans have been willing to buy so much of our debt and finance our deficits doesn't mean that they're going to do that forever. And if they are, it's going to cost us more and more in interest payments. Interest payments, you know, continue to eat up more and more of our budgets every year. And I mean, I just think that there's no question that the time has come for us to get our fiscal house in order, much like the Clinton administration did in 93 and 94. The time has come.
I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, William Cohan.
Thank you.
Again, William Cohan is New York Times online columnist and a former investment banker and author of House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the gun runners who were caught down in Arizona with hundreds of assault rifles on their way to the Mexican cartels. This is Background Briefing, and I'm Ian Masters, and I'm speaking with Gerald Nunziato, who is a partner in the firm Crime Gun Solutions. He's a former special agent of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, where, among other duties, he served as the Firearms Interdiction Program Manager and a special agent in charge of ATF's National Tracing Center. He is an internationally recognized expert on tracing guns used in crimes. In essence, he developed the techniques now used to trace gun crimes, which, of course, we're familiar with from the CSI shows on television. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gerald Nunziato.
Thank you for having me.
And, of course, yesterday in Arizona, 20 gun runners, let's call them what they are, have been charged with buying roughly 700 guns in Arizona near the border, apparently with the intent to sell them to the Sinaloa cartel in Mexico. Do you consider this a big bust or same.
Unfortunately, yes. It just shows you the money that's involved. You know, the weapons that these people are buying are averaged between $550 and $600 a piece, and that's almost $500,000 worth of guns they're buying. They're not hobbyists. They definitely do not have our government in interest when they're doing this. It's great to see that the government was able to step in and stop these people.
Well, funnily enough, it's actually tragic that since the Arizona shooting of the congresswoman and all those other innocent victims, there's barely a mention of guns. And it just shows you the political power of the gun lobby in this country to simply erase this issue from the public discourse. At least somebody seems to be doing something about guns, at least from your perspective as a former ATF officer. Did you ever feel like you were tilting at windmills, that the Congress didn't have your back?
Yes. We had to be very, very careful about gun issues. And when I worked in Ohio as an agent, it was very difficult to investigate gun dealers because of the pressures involved with Congress and congressmen interceding with in our investigation. So most agents just shied away from it. It was easier to go after an individual. But unfortunately, a gun dealer could supply thousands of guns to criminals, and you just can't go out and arrest each one of them. You have to get the source, and the dealers know it. And it's unfortunate that the people of Arizona don't realize that somebody could spend $500,000 on guns are not legitimate people. If they're trading this money, had to be generated from something. Other crimes, drug trafficking. So they're actually protecting the drug industry by not wanting to approach and look at this gun issue. It's twofold. Where are they getting the money, and why are they buying the guns? And if they start realizing that the guns that are being purchased with dirty money, they may take some effort to stop this flow.
So, General Nunziata, can you tie in these two recent events in Arizona? The shooting of the congresswoman and the person that's arrested apparently was able to buy this gun that he was able to conceal because of the lax gun laws in Arizona. And he also, as we know, had 33-round magazine clips, two of them, could have done a lot more damage. Mercifully, people stopped him. He was able to buy this gun, apparently filled out the requisite forms, but there was no linkage to his mental problems. And I'm wondering whether the process, it works at all. The FBI had nothing in their database about this guy. ATF, I don't imagine, has it either. So if an individual can buy a gun that easily with his record of mental problems, little wonder that people on the border can buy hundreds of guns.
Exactly. And, I kind of prescribe to what the gun lobby always say, guns don't kill, people do. So why don't we start regulating the people? Let's leave the gun alone and not regulate it, but regulate the people that are buying these guns and do some better checks and make sure that these people are stable in buying them. If you could track guns, like in our country since the 30s, we've been able to buy Al Capone-type weapons, machine guns, bazookas, grenade launchers. These are in the hands of American citizens that are legally registered, and they're rarely, if ever, used in crime. And these are, in theory, weapons of major destruction compared to a handgun. And because there's some responsibility and the people that buy these guns are regulated, we should do the same thing for conventional weapons. Regulate the people that are buying them, just like the gun lobby says. Guns don't kill, people do. So let's do something about these people that are buying the guns. Again, the databases aren't catching up to all this because of the restrictions, budget cuts, who's entering the data, how the data is being entered. If it's spelled, the name's spelled wrong, or date of birth is transposed, the person could escape detection. But if we did a little extra effort and work with gun dealers to enforce some type of regulation on these people, it would make everybody safer.
But I understand General Nunziata, again, who is a former ATF special agent with the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Agency, and he developed the National Tracing Center. He's an internationally recognized expert on tracing guns. We're talking about the arrest in Arizona of 20 individuals along with 700 assault rifles, and included in this cache, by the way, of brand-new AK-47s, there was also a 50-caliber machine gun. Now, that can shoot down a 747, and as you know, you can buy these 50-caliber sniper rifles, and you can buy explosive rounds for them online, apparently. That would take down a 747. So They're
advertised as such that you could take down an airplane, a helicopter, or an armored vehicle. I mean, it's amazing why we are advertising weapons in our country that could do that.
I was going to ask you, though, about the effect, though, on your work when you're an ATF agent and on your colleagues that are at work today, and apparently down in Arizona they managed to at least arrest some people. The Tyard, is it called the Tyard Amendment? He's a congressman from Kansas, I think.
Yes, Tyard.
Now, explain to the audience how that absolutely cripples the ATF's, the government's law enforcement bureau charged with stopping illicit gun trafficking. How does that cripple your colleagues' work?
Well, the tracing center was started, modernized with the agreement of 10 compact states along the East Coast to share gun data to stop the movement of crime guns. And the tracing center was given money by our government to facilitate a central location to support local law enforcement to help track gun movement. And what TIARD Amendment did, it prevents local police departments from knowing where the guns are going, like this gun shop that was selling the guns in Glendale. If the guns aren't recovered or recovered in another city, the police officer in Glendale are now prohibited from finding out where the guns are being recovered.
By the way,
go through a lot of loops and bells. So it's very difficult for local law enforcement to understand the criminal activity of guns because of the TIARD Amendment.
I just wanted to interject there that our audience may think you're referring to Glendale, California. It's Glendale, Arizona, where the Lone Wolf Trading Company was one of the supplied 100 AK-47s. Now, just explain the mechanism. You developed the National Tracing Center's ability to trace guns. So that means that if the cops go to a local crime scene, they have nowhere to turn to find out where this gun came from?
No, they could find for that particular gun, but that could be one of 500 guns that were purchased by a straw purchaser. And unless they specifically ask ATF for more information, they won't get it. But the worst thing about this TIARD Amendment is that it gives the gun industry, the gun dealers, all the knowledge in the world that the guns that they're selling are turning up in crimes, like this dealer in Glendale, Arizona. He would know that the guns that he sold to these people are turning up in crime. He may not know exactly where, but now he could give word to these people, say, hey, ATF is now calling me. But the Glendale police wouldn't know because ATF would be prohibited from telling them. And this is how the gun lobby, who claims this is to protect Americans, is actually protecting the gun dealers to sell guns to criminals.
And, in fact, in collusion with the criminals, if it's true that a guy that's knowingly selling assault rifles to a shady guy with piles of cash that looks like he's associated with the drug cartels. If this guy's a good customer and he gets a call from ATF looking into these guns, the guy that's selling the gun can give that information that the ATF called to the gun runner?
Exactly. And when I was an agent for 9 years, when I was at the tracing center, we had thousands of these occurrences. Now, we traced during my tenure, there are a little over 1.5 million crime guns, and several hundred thousand times the gun dealer exposed our cases to the criminals, that our agents or police officers specifically asked us not to contact that dealer because they knew the dealer would give information to the criminals or the purchasers. Yet never once did we ever have a problem with a police officer interfering with another agent's investigation by disclosing information to the criminals. And it's in this TIARD Amendment is protecting the gun dealers that we know in law enforcement have provided detailed information to criminals, and it punishes the law enforcement. Initially, they even wanted to charge law enforcement officers with a felony to tell another law enforcement official about a crime gun, but not penalize whatsoever the gun dealer from telling their customers that the ATF is aware of their purchase.
That seems extraordinary, and this is the law of the land. And
yes.
Why do you think that nobody can go after this Kansas congressman and all of those people who voted for it and say, you guys and girls, I guess, have got blood on your hands?
Well, it's even worse than that. The only major law enforcement national organization to support this amendment was the FOP. And it's amazing how many police officers have been killed this week.
FOP
and how many
being
have been killed, yet they agree that law enforcement shouldn't get information on gun people that have been involved with gun crime because they don't trust law enforcement, but they trust the gun dealers. That law enforcement in my career, like I say, had tens of thousands of times they've asked not to contact a dealer because of their fear the dealer was going to leak information. And somebody should ask the FOP, why are they doing this?
What's the FOP? Sorry.
That's the Fraternal Order of Police.
I see, and that's a big union. Is it?
Yes.
It's not the only one, though, is it? I thought there were some police organizations that really did want gun control.
Oh, yes. Like you got the International Association of Police of Chiefs. Numerous major law enforcement concerns support the removal of this Tiahrt Amendment, or spoke out against it. Most major city police departments are against it. But the FOP is the only recognized major law enforcement agency that supports this absurd law.
And they can't
justify it because it's impossible for them to show that law enforcement, or even what they call under the Freedom Information, where you could buy the trace data, but it's 5 years old. The data is 5 years old. It doesn't give any names. It doesn't give addresses. It's absurd what they're trying to say. And it's basically, there's a reason for it, and I don't know.
Right.
Well, nobody's really going to ask.
Well, obviously, the FOP is in bed with the NRA. So I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles. I'm afraid we're out of time, Gerald Nunziato.
Thank you.
Again, he has served as a Firearms Interdiction Program Manager and Special Agent in charge of ATF's National Tracing Center. That's the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Internationally recognized expert on tracing guns used in crimes. Let's now take a brief station break, and we'll be back going to Cairo, Egypt, for an update on what's happening on the streets there today. This is Background Briefing, and I'm Ian Masters, and I'm speaking with Samia Sarah-Galdon, who is a writer, political essayist, editor, and literary critic. She was born and raised in Egypt, educated in Europe, and then emigrated to the United States. Her autobiographical novel, The Cairo House, traces political developments in Egypt over the past three decades, including the rise of Islamism and Sadat's assassination. She joins us from Cairo. And on day two of the revolution, or the pre-revolution, what did you witness today in the streets of Cairo, Samia?
Maybe a little soon to call it a pre-revolution or a revolution. Time will tell. But certainly a second day of massive demonstrations and protests across the country. And that's very, very, very momentous for Egypt, because the law of assembly that makes it illegal under martial law has meant that.
Are you there? You were saying the imposition of martial law has meant. So if you could just pick it up from there.
Right. And that's since Sadat's assassination. So that's 30 years ago now, that the assembly is illegal. And that's pretty much kept any protest or demonstration, at least any massive ones, off the streets in Egypt. But the Tunisian example seems to have been a great Zardoz moment, a moment when it was revealed that things were possible and people have started demonstrating and protesting and flooding the streets, something unheard of, unimaginable until very, very recently. A sort of audacity of hope that the Tunisian example has set for Egyptians. And that's the great excitement that's going on right now. No one really knows what the results will be of this. There's a fair amount of dread along with a hope. But at the same time, it's extremely exciting because this is so unimaginable up to a few weeks ago before the Tunisian example made it seem that everything is possible. So that's very remarkable in itself. So a second day of protests and demonstrations, the police seem to have held their fire, at least at the beginning. But as they went on, of course, the protests were broken up. But just the fact that the police did not come down in force right away is, again, significant. And also reports coming in from the provinces, not just from Cairo, but from the provinces as well. And this is all building up on months of widespread discontent from many, many different levels of society, not necessarily the poorest, university professors, the judiciary, lawyers, judges in particular, who were pretty much sidelined during the recent October elections and felt humiliated, felt sidelined. All of these levels of protest have been building up, but there was not the courage to go ahead with protests until the past 2 days. So that's very, very remarkable.
So, again, Samir Sarigaldin, who is in Cairo, the author of The Cairo House, who we're talking about today, the day after yesterday's street protests that were called the Day of Anger. They coincided with Police Day. And I guess the fact that they started out being nice to the police and trying to co-opt them, and after a while somebody must have given the police orders to get tough, right?
Yes. But they did hold fire for a very long time and quite often let the demonstrators through, at least that's what it looks like or what's been reported, for a while. So again, either that was under orders or just that they, that the police themselves were not sure what they should be doing or felt perhaps some sympathy with what was going on. But I think it had largely to do with the fact that the demonstrators made a point of not being confrontational, that they put on mass messages all stressed that they would not be violent. And as you know, Twitter and Facebook and so on came down, were blocked early on, since yesterday, actually. Since yesterday, Twitter's been off and Facebook to a large extent, because those social networks were used to organize protests, and just as cell phones were used to post videos on YouTube, including a sort of Tiananmen Square moment. But I think the most important thing is that the demand up to the moment, up to now, forget the slogans, forget that people are chanting in the street, but the demands, the actual demands so far, have been fairly limited. Dissolution of parliament, new elections that would not be fraudulent, resignation of the Minister of the Interior, and raising the minimum wage. Because although the government has in recent years been vaunting its growth, the growth of Egypt, but that has not seemed to trickle down to the masses who are suffering increasingly because some food subsidies have been, and food prices have gone up massively. And unemployment is rampant. Job opportunities for the educated are even less available than for the uneducated, and that's building up on the discontent and the feeling that whatever the growth rate in Egypt, it's not trickling down to the majority of people, and that is stressing the great disparity in income, plus the fact that in recent years there has been a relatively high degree of freedom of the press, means that the opposition press has been reporting scandals, corruption among government officials and business tycoons. And in many cases, those are one and the same. The business tycoons are government officials or ministers. And that led to a perception of not only massive income disparity, but also massive corruption. And that has been one of the strongest rallying points for these protests.
And Egypt, of course, is a country where 40% of the nation lives on less than $2 a day. And when you talk about raising the minimum wage, it's obviously got nowhere to go but up. I take it, though, that most of these demonstrations represent the younger generation in Egypt who are born after the 82-year-old Hosni Mubarak came to power in 1981.
That's true. That's absolutely true. And again, so far, the protesters do not seem to be the poorest of the poor by any means. They seem to be largely middle-class university students, younger people, as you said yourself, more, you know, with some level of education at any rate, technically savvy with cell phones and computers and so on. But that's rather typical of such movement, that they would be in the forefront. They're often joined by people in the street, but this movement, this movement is clearly not led by the poorest of the poor, unlike the bread strikes during Sadat's time, the very serious bread strikes during Sadat's time that were very much a mass movement of people who were really on the poverty line. And those were the striking factory workers and very poor people. This is not the case this time. It's mostly, as you said, very young people who were born into the Mubarak regime. But also, there is very widespread support, as I said, among university professors who've had a movement called the 9th of March against what they perceived as academic or non-freedom of academia, judges, lawyers, the judiciary. It's very much wider spread than just the students and young people who see no future and no jobs. So I think that's important to keep in mind.
It seems, though, from what I can glean from press reports, Samia Sarigeldin, again, the author of The Cairo House, which has traced the political development of Egypt for the past three decades, and including the rise of Islamism and Sadat's assassination, and she's joining us from Cairo. It seems to me that the Egyptian spirit is wounded. This is a sort of wounded country. I take it that a lot of Egyptians watching the revolution in Tunisia were in effect embarrassed at their own weakness in contrast to the courage of the Tunisians. And is this true that there's a sense that this country that was the heart of the Arab world and particularly of Arab intellectualism has languished over the decades?
Your interpretation is perfectly on target. It's a perfectly on target interpretation because in effect, there were several copycat attempts on the part of Egyptians to copy the martyrdom of the Tunisian street vendor who set fire to himself. There were several attempts and people who died in the attempt, setting fire to themselves, throwing themselves off of buildings, and there was a very strong feeling that in the street that the Tunisians are men, as Arabs put it in Arabic, and that Egyptians needed to show the same kind of guts. And really, it took, in a sense, it was almost a sense of the emperor has no clothes, but closer to the Dardoz moment in that film when the curtain is pulled aside and it's shown that it is possible. So the fact that the Tunisians could do it and could do it in 2 or 3 days, they could bring about this change, this massive, unimaginable change when Ben Ali had been in power for almost as long as Mubarak. I think everyone believes was the great catalyst for the inspiration for this massive street movement. Now, whether it brings about the same change in a country so much larger, more powerful, more complex than Tunisia, and with a geopolitical position that is so much more critical to global politics than is Tunisia because of Egypt's involvement in peace treaties in the region and so on, whether this will be allowed to happen in Egypt or whether it could happen is another matter altogether. Plus, in Tunisia, the army stood aside. The army has not spoken in Egypt yet, and I'm sure you know that that is what, in the end, will tip the balance one way or the other, because the police have been used, yes, And the police is a tremendous force in Egypt. And in recent years, the police force has been seen as not representing the service of the people, but representing the security apparatus for the regime. And the police itself has been the focus of a great deal of criticism on the part of ordinary citizens and complaints about police brutality. At the moment, all of these complaints are focused on the Minister of the Interior, who runs the police force. But, as I said, the police has been used. The army has not been called into play at all. And that is a very crucial matter. And again, the status of Egypt in global politics is very different from that of Tunisia. So what is imaginable for Tunisia may not be imaginable for Egypt, but for the people in the street, there is a tremendous urge for change. And as you said, in a sense, we heard several protesters in the street saying, oh, you know, we're not being treated as human beings. Our intelligence is being insulted when there are elections with results that show more than 98% of the vote going to the NDP, the National Party, which is Mubarak's party. They feel their intelligence is being insulted. They feel their humanity is being insulted when they are not treated as whole citizens. And again, the press, the opposition press in recent years has had the freedom to make this kind of point, to tell the Egyptian citizen, are you a man or a mouse? Can you make yourself heard? And so on. And yesterday and today, they've been heard. But whether they would be satisfied with a limited result or push for a more radical change, that's not clear. At this point, it is not clear.
Well, in a way, Samir Saragelden, you're describing what happened recently in Iran, in the sense that the Iranian people were so insulted by the election being stolen that they rose up. And of course, we know what their fate was. When you said that Egypt is, of course, so different from Tunisia and it's very geostrategically important and it has peace treaties with Israel, etc., that it won't be allowed to fall apart, that implies that somebody outside of Egypt is holding it together. So explain that.
Just to go back for a minute to what you said about Iran, I should say that, again, the Iranian example was one followed very, very closely in Egypt. I do want to pick up on your remark there, that the Iranian example also was followed very closely in Egypt. And admired and used as a model. But I would, without going into speculation, I think it's something that's really hard to argue against, that superpowers around the world have a very strong vested interest in Egypt, and the U.S. in particular has a very strong vested interest in security in the region and in the role that it sees Egypt, which is its client state, as far as aid is concerned, the role that it sees Egypt playing, and the fact that it has, of course, a tremendous influence, if only through the billions in aid that come to Egypt from the U.S. So it's very much, I would say it's apparent that that the U.S. at least can play a tremendous role in the area, but also other players in the region, regional players, as well as the U.S. will have a strong interest in the outcome.
Well, clearly, by the way, the U.S. aid to Egypt, $1.2 billion a year, is mostly military aid. The Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, in a press conference, told reporters yesterday that the Egyptian government is stable and looking for ways to respond to the legitimate needs and interests of the Egyptian people. Do you does that strike you as being what's happening there with the Egyptian government?
It's hard to tell at this point if Secretary Clinton's assessment on the stability of Egypt is entirely justified. Hard to tell at this point. The fact is that the roots of discontent are very deep, and I think one outcome, at any rate, is that it will be very hard for President Mubarak to pass on the succession to his son, because much of the resentment has focused on the idea of a succession. What is called in Egypt the inheritance scenario, inheritance from father to son, as was the case in Iraq or in Syria or in other countries of the region. So I think this will these demonstrations and protests will very much reinforce this rejection of the inheritance scenario. So therefore, now it will be, since President Mubarak is an elderly man, again, the question will pose itself even more urgently, and events today and yesterday will certainly influence that outcome. So I think Secretary Clinton was speaking possibly prescriptively, as descriptively possibly, when she talked about the stability of Egypt. Perhaps she was reassuring as much as commenting.
Well, just in closing, Samir Saragalan, telephoning you has been difficult when the line's been cut off a bunch of times, and there are reports that the government is trying to close down social networks and texting and cell phone interference. And is that happening? I'm not suggesting that they're trying to diminish this call, although it's taken us a while to get through to you, and the quality hasn't been good.
I know certain that Twitter, for instance, has been down since yesterday. Also, some of the websites of some of the opposition press were down. They may be up again, but some of them were down. So some websites have been down. Twitter has been down. Facebook has been down. This phone call was interrupted 3 or 4 times. Other phone calls from overseas were not. So that's about as far as I care to comment at this point.
Well, I thank you for joining us here in Los Angeles, Samir Saragalan. Thank you so much for joining us from Cairo.
Very much enjoyed our conversation. Thank you.
I did too. Again, I've been speaking with Samir Saragalan, who's a writer, political essayist, editor, and literary critic. She was born and raised in Egypt, educated in Europe, and then emigrated to the United States. Her autobiographical novel, The Cairo House, traces political developments in Egypt over the past 3 decades, including the rise of Islamism and Sadat's assassination. And she joined us today from Cairo.